This is WBCR LP Great Barrington, Berkshire Community Radio, broadcasting at 97.7 FM and streaming at berkshireradio.org.
This is our planet, the one that we all share.
On today's Farm and Garden Show with J. Ellison Moscariello and Bill Taylor, we talk with farmer Elizabeth Keene at Indian Line Farm in South Egremont, the nation's first community-supported agriculture farm created in 1985. First, some upcoming events. The Great Barrington Seed Library needs a coordinator to provide this community resource. Contact the Great Barrington Public Library at 413-528-1619, extension 6000. Once again, 413-528-1619, extension 6000. Millerton Farmers Market is at 6 Dutchess Avenue, Millerton, New York. Saturdays 10 to 2 year-round. Housie Dome, also known as the Housatonic Community Center, has a farmer's market once a month, 1064 Main Street, Housatonic, Mass., 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Saturdays, January 18th, February 15th, March 15th, and April 19th. Vendors offer an abundance of locally grown food, including fresh greens, winter squash, root crops, apples, meat, cheese, jam, honey, and maple syrup, baked goods, and more. Local artists and crafters round out the market offerings, and each market features live music. Markets welcome SNAP and HIP. SNAP users receive a market match of up to $30 per market, and each market includes vendors with HIP-eligible products, providing SNAP shoppers with an immediate reimbursement for benefit dollars spent on fresh fruits and vegetables. Indian Line Farm has a booth at this market. Carrots, apples, locally roasted coffee, sharp cheese, and fresh bread. The Winter Pittsfield Farmers Market welcomes in farmers and artisans together. You may meet a collective of young farmers who plow by horsepower. You may sample winter squash or hot cider. The year-round market is teen-led through Roots Rising, a program that helps teens to work at farms and food pantries throughout the Berkshires and supports crews working on local farms and the crew who runs the market in all seasons. They are working toward building a food truck crew as well. From November to April, the Pittsfield Winter Farmers Market runs monthly at the Zion Lutheran Church next to the Pittsfield Common. Saturdays, January 11th, February and March 8th, April 12th, from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. Information on these markets can be found at berkshiregrown.org. Sheffield Winter Farmers Market will be held second Saturdays through March from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Dewey Hall, 91 Main Street, Sheffield, Mass., January 11th, February 8th, and March 8th. Vendor applications and other information at sheffieldfarmersmarket.org. Berkshire Botanical Garden in Stockbridge offers many classes on gardening, horticulture, cooking, and other garden-related topics, even in winter. The website berkshirebotanical.org/events has listings. Their phone is 413-298-3926. Again, 413-298-3926. And email is info@berkshirebotanical.org.
Elizabeth Keene first got interested in farming while working for peace in Central America. Her and Alexander Thorpe's love story began with farming. They met as farm apprentices in 1995 at Mahewee Harvest. In 1996, Elizabeth was working for Robin Van En, one of the founders of the Community Supported Agriculture CSA movement at Indian Line Farm. After Robin's untimely death in 1997, Al and Elizabeth entered into a partnership with the Nature Conservancy and the Community Land Trust in the Southern Berkshires to preserve Indian Line Farm as a working farm. Its cornerstones are farmland affordability, watershed and wildlife habitat conservation, and community involvement in sustainable food production. Good morning.
Hi.
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 Good morning, Elizabeth. How are you? This is Jay.
I'm doing well. Yeah. Hey, nice to see you.
How are you in this lovely morning?
Doing great. Thank you.
All right. So we're going to get right to it.
So welcome, Elizabeth Keene. How did you first get involved in farming?
How did I first get involved in farming? I got involved in farming after working for 3 years in Central America, primarily in Guatemala and Southern Mexico. And it was during that time I was working with refugees, and these folks were subsistence farmers for years and years and years. Like that was their occupation. I wanted to understand what does it mean to earn your living from the land? And I realized that what I wanted to do was be able to, with a lot of these refugee communities, they were returning to Guatemala, and there was actually a lot of NGO money to encourage them to expand their diets to other foods besides just corn and beans. And so I thought, well, wow, I'll go home and I will learn how to grow vegetables and then I'll come back and I will have more of a technical skill to be able to offer a population that I felt could use some help. And so that was my goal, but that goal got thwarted along the way and I found myself an Indian line farm. I also was mainly humbled by the fact that how could a young 20-something year old go home, imagine that they could learn how to grow food, bring that very nascent knowledge down to a different country with different growing methods, all of that. It was sort of paternalistic of my 20-year-old self. Very good intentions, but
Oh, it
I
sounded
realized,
beautiful.
It did, yeah.
Sounded beautiful.
And I think
So,
we all believe we know everything when we're in our 20s. I think
yeah, we
I
certainly
did.
do. We want to save the world. I know I
Yeah.
did. Tell our listeners, please, if you will, the story of the farm's name, Indian Line.
Yeah, so the farm name was created by the folks who were here before Robin Van Ende. So that would have been the Proctor family. And this was a dairy farm. They came here and they started a dairy farm. I think it was 1724, depending on how you look at history. Most of Egremont was deeded. The indigenous people sold their land to the white early settlers of Egremont. And as we know, that's a very complicated way to say that, but that's what the deed says. And the deed created two lines, a northerly line and a southerly line, that allowed free passage for the indigenous to travel from the Taconic River in New York to the Housatonic River in Massachusetts. So it was a safe zone. And so our farm, originally, the northerly line of the Indian line was the border or the boundary of this farm. And so the dairy farmers, when they came here, they liked that aspect of the history and they wanted to have the name reflect some historical significance. And so they named it the Indian Line Farm.
But they came much later than 1724.
They came much later, yes. So that was in the early 1900s.
Okay, great.
So you want to tell us a little bit about what is the history of the farm? We heard a little bit about it. And who was Robin Van Ende? And also, how many acres are still in the farm?
So originally, the farm was well over 100 acres. We're now 16.5 acres. So the short story is that the dairy farmers got out of the business in the early 80s. The land was bought by a developer. He divided the land above, like across the street, created one, if not three house lots off the land that had been in pasture. And then the farm down below stayed intact. So then the farm was purchased by Robin in like 1983. And it was in 1986 or 1985 that she met Jean Van der Tuyn. He's actually originally from Pittsfield, but he had gone to Europe and had been inspired by some things that he saw. And that was his experience. There's other experiences of people in the Deep South who also had these farmer-to-consumer relationships. But his experience was he went to Europe, he came back, and he was looking for a farm where he could inspire folks to look at a model that would directly create a relationship between consumers and the farmer directly, cutting out the middle people. And he wasn't successful immediately. There were some farms lower along the coast. Anyway, he ended up at the Schumacher Center here in Egremont. And Susan Witt strongly recommended that he come visit Robin. Robin had this farm. I don't think it was really being farmed to its full potential. And she had a more horticultural experience. This site became the first site of the original CSA. And we have minutes that documented the creation of the name Community Supported Agriculture. And those minutes and notebooks are currently at the Schumacher Center. So if anybody wanted to go look at them, it's quite interesting. The sort of mundane things that people were talking about during the creation of this thing called Community Supported Agriculture that really has become this both movement, I think is what they called it originally. It's a very concrete way for farmers to run their business. So that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Robin, I met her after being an apprentice for a season at the Mehewi Harvest CSA in Housatonic, which is no longer a farm. It's now North Plain Farm. I met her during these really great study sessions that they were having that were sponsored by the UMass Extension and Kathy Roth, who is an extension leader living in, well, her office was in Pittsfield. Anyway, I met Robin that way. And when I finished my apprenticeship, Kathy Roth said, hey, you should go talk to Robin. She is organizing the very first CSA conference in the country, and she could use some help. Because this was in 1996. The first CSA was here from 86 to 89. And then I think as all very well-intentioned people sometimes don't get along, the farm actually moved to North Plain Farm. And though they, I think, tried to keep the farm going here for a couple of years, it didn't keep going. And so when we got here in 1997, there was essentially no business.
Wow.
Wow.
That's pretty amazing. So you got there on land that had been left to furlough. Is that what it was like when you got
yeah.
there? Fallow. Did I say
fallow? Fallow is the word. Yeah, fallow. Robin had it hayed. There were dairy farmers around and other people who would sell hay. I know it was hayed for a number of years. And then in 95 or 94, there was a project that was started by some local farmers to start a winter squash cooperative. Mm-hmm. To be able to sell to Hannaford's grocery stores. And there was a gentleman who lived in Tearingham. This was his project, and he got a lot of local farmers to grow winter squash. I know Robin leased her land out prior to her death. That's what was happening here for at least a couple of years.
Oh.
It was a lot of butternut squash being grown.
Hmm. Well, that sounds fantastic.
Somewhere on your website, I was able to find a link to a map, but it looks like you have about 10 acres that are vegetable production, maybe 1 acre or a little under an acre of perennial crops. There's a north and a south field, I think. And then you've got buffer areas in the rest of your 16 acres. It's 4 or 5 acres of buffer.
Yeah.
So what do you grow there now?
We grow actually about 5 acres of intense vegetables every year. The other remaining 5 acres, as you're mentioning, is in usually cover crops.
Mm-hmm.
So it's rye vetch mixes or oat peas or some other kind of cover crop. We grow all vegetables. We grow for the Great Barrington Farmers Market, and we grow for our 250 plus member CSA, and then to a few stores and restaurants. Over the years, we've very much expanded what we grow, and now we grow year round. So we have 3 30 by 96 houses that we grow greens in 12 months out of the year.
Yeah, we were just at the
winter market.
The winter market in Housatonic,
yeah.
And
yeah.
It's all your produce.
I have a very selfish question.
Yeah, wait, what is it?
Because I am so addicted to your daikon, those purple and those green.
Yeah.
If I wanted to get my hands on those today, how would I obtain them?
Yeah, so we...
Because I ran out of all the ones we got.
Full. I have a walk-in cooler full of them, but I keep my winter off time pretty set because you're probably not the only person to say, hey, can I have something? And I pretty much just say no because daikon radishes keep for a really long time. I'm keeping them in my cooler and you can keep them in your cooler. So
right. This
January...
I'm going to load up.
Just buy more. Yeah.
I will buy a lot more. It's ridiculous how good they are.
I know. They're fantastic. I agree. Yeah. I'm pretty protective of my off time. So
I understand.
And also the Berkshire Grown Markets are so great for us. We can do a harvest on a full day and then we can sell everything on a day or a couple hours. And then I have my time off and I work a lot from March through mid-November. And so just like teachers, it's really important that I protect a little bit of time for...
You have to. You absolutely have to. I mean, Bill and I, you know, just very briefly, we ran a farm in Northern California and
okay. There's
no time off.
Right. I mean, thank God we don't live in California.
And it was insane. We started out saying when we started the farm, we said, okay, one day a week, we're going to have day off. And then we said one day a month, and we didn't do that. And then it was like, you know how it goes.
After a while, we were able to get away for maybe 1 month when it's really dark from,
Yeah,
in
when
late
there's nothing
December to
happening.
January.
Yeah.
But light comes back, and out there, you're a little further south. We were
Yeah,
up
yeah.
Northern California.
So that led to where can people find your produce now? So it's the winter farmer market. So we're in the winter period. Is it the winter farmer market? That's it.
Yeah. At this point, that's pretty much it. Occasionally, depending on how the greenhouses are doing, I'll do a pop-up sale at the farm. And I advertise those. I have an email list, so all people have to do is go to my website and subscribe, and then I'll send out a notice, and we get a ton of people that will come here, and I'll sell for 2 hours, and I get to go on my merry way, and everyone gets some fresh veggies.
And what's your website?
So it's IndianLineFarm.com.
That's easy. Great. So, in terms of growing methods, there are all kinds of things. There's no-till, and there's kind of a fad around no-till. And we actually had Will Brinton on our show, and part of it is a thing by the herbicide companies to get you to do no-till and then use a lot more herbicides. And then there's no-till that's much more honest, I would say, and can be truly organic. You have 5 acres. It's hard to do hand tools, so I'm sure you use some machinery for
Yeah,
that.
I learned from a couple really great people. All of our experience, Al and I's experience, is learning by doing. I didn't have the opportunity to go to school before this. And so the way I would describe our practices is that we try to be as minimally tillaged as possible. My main goal is to have land be covered all the time with something growing. So it's very important to me that we have winter cover crops, summer cover crops. I've been experimenting a little bit more with keeping the cover crops on longer before tilling. We do have tractors. We actually have way more tractors than the size warrants, but that's okay. We do use a fair amount of hand tools, especially for cultivating. All of the harvest is done by hand. We don't have any lettuce cutting machines. We don't grow potatoes, so I don't have like potato harvesters or anything.
Okay,
Yeah, I don't know if that describes it.
no, that definitely describes it.
now before you said that there you have 5 acres that are in cover crop and 5 acres that are cropping, and I'm wondering, is that sort of an annual thing? You in a particular year you'll have cover crop that year, and then the next year you'll be growing on it. So you alternate, you go back and forth.
Yeah, right. So actually, the way it is that my goal is to grow on a piece of land for 2 years and then a year in cover crop. So there's a 3 year rotation that way.
Got it.
That's how I look at it.
What about rotations during those 2 years that you're cropping?
Yeah, I mean, we really try not to grow brassicas on the same place. I keep good maps so I know where I grew what. We don't grow a lot of any one thing. So the rotation doesn't have to be as strict, I think, as if I were to be growing an acre of broccoli. Of course, I would never want to grow broccoli on that land for a while. But sometimes when you're planting bed by bed, occasionally, yeah, I might have broccoli having followed kale, or kale might have been planted there 3 years ago. But I do my best to just rotate the family crops.
And the reason you don't do broccoli for a long time is pests, nutrient
Yeah,
use.
pests, they're super heavy feeders. Flea beetles are really bad in the Northeast, so I don't want to grow a crop that the flea beetles love.
You don't want to feed those
I
beetles.
don't, right, exactly. Right.
And do row covers help with that some?
Absolutely. Yes. I actually now we grow a spring broccoli crop and then spring kale, and then of course all the other, the arugula, the mustard greens, the turnips, the radishes, all that stuff. All of those get covered with floating row cover. But one of the things I've been doing the last couple of years is like I cut out any mid-season broccoli and I only grow it in the late fall. I also cut out Brussels sprouts because I couldn't keep those free of the flea beetles, which then can pass Alternaria. But the last couple of years, I've been successfully keeping Rime on my kale for the entire season. And it has worked magic. I'm keeping these brassicas for a much longer period of time rather than having to do a second planting. So I'm actually going to try it with Brussels sprouts, and I'm going to get, they have a couple different kinds of insect nets. They have exclude net, and then there's protect net. And I'm going to do an experiment. I'm going to try to grow those again, because if you can keep the flea beetles off of them, you're worlds ahead.
Yeah, and boy, do we love Brussels sprouts. My
Yeah,
favorite
I used to
crop
grow them. I
is.
used to grow them a lot. And it was kind of like 1 year in three, there'd be a really great crop. And then the other years, they'd have a little browning on the outside, but people would still buy them. And then I stopped and I did. I have people asking me, how come you don't grow Brussels sprouts anymore? I was
Well, that
tired of leaving them in the field because they were so yuck.
I know.
I'm excited about trying them again.
Well, really good luck with those.
Now, what about inputs? And you've probably got pretty good soil. You've got bottomland soil.
Yep, we have what's called a hero silt loam, which is considered a class one prime farmland. And we do make our own compost. When it was readily available, we would get the muck from inside dairy barns. But increasingly, the dairy farmers are using that material more and more, at least around here. So I've had a really hard time getting manure. So anybody listening has some manure they want to send my way, I'd be happy to take it off your hands. So for years, I used Lancaster Ag, which is a great company in Pennsylvania, and they would be really great at analyzing soil tests. And so we would do mineral blends and put those on in the fall. And then we'd do a certified organic pre-plant mixture of humates and micronutrients. They went out of business, but I now use composted chicken manure. That's my primary source of nitrogen at this point. And then our hope is to put compost on at least once every 3 years. But again, it's been really hard for me to get it. I'm contemplating this year actually just going for it and buying pre-made compost, which will be a chunk of change, but it really makes such a difference
I
to
can't even
crops.
imagine your stuff
Now,
being any better, quite honestly.
there's some local places you can get compost, and I also wonder what's really in it. And then there's Vermont compost, which is very pricey, but some other farms swear by it. So I was
Oh, yeah.
wondering.
So we use Vermont compost for all of our potting soil mixes, and it really is night and day. And not to disparage other companies that are local, there's another company in New York that we've purchased from for years and years, and they're great, but the quality is not there. It's not the same. The nutrient level isn't the same. It varies from year to year. So Vermont compost, we use for all of our potting soil as best as we possibly can. Sometimes we run out and it is pricey. So if you can't get it in a large quantity, we go in on an order with other farms
Oh,
so
that's
that we can
nice.
get the least expensive rate. Yeah. We use seven of these 1,500-pound sling bags a year. So it's a lot. And we get our soil tested about every other year. And the gentleman, Dan Kittredge, he started an
Oh,
organization that
yeah.
all about nutrient-dense food. And I think he got people really turned on to looking not just at the NPK, but really looking at the whole picture of the soil and the micronutrients. So we do get a soil test that gives us all of that information. And so we will look at those micronutrients and make sure that we're putting those back on the soil. I've done a lot of different things over the years, and I learned all about biodynamic techniques. I took a year-long course at the Pfeiffer Center in Chestnut Hill, New York. And there's a lot of ways to focus your energy in terms of giving your land the nutrients that it needs. And then there's the practical time and energy and money that it takes to be able to do that in a way that you really want. So at this point, for practical purposes, we get compost done when we can. We use a variety of different sources about where the manure can come from. And then we do use these Crayer pre-plant mixes. They're certified organic chicken manure.
Well,
Now you say
you'll be.
Crayer, you say
That's
Crayer.
Crayers. It's Krehers.
I always say the proof is in the pudding. You eat your stuff, you know that it is coming from good soil and it's coming from a lot of love and a lot of good tender handling.
I just want to ask a little more about Crayer. Is that a company?
Yeah, it's a company. It's in New York, and it is a certified organic granulated chicken manure.
Oh, okay.
So I want to go on to another matter, and I want to ask about the annual garlic harvest and other volunteer days that you have.
Yeah. From June through the like mid-October, every Wednesday morning is considered volunteer day. And so we allow people to come. You don't necessarily have to be a CSA member. I don't really advertise it broadly, but it's fine. Any person can come. And primarily on those volunteer days, it's the only day I really make my crew or try to hand weed. So it's a bunch of people, hands and knees, harvesting carrots, beets, direct seeded crops that we've done all we can to with hoes or our cultivating tractors. And then there's harvesting of green beans and cherry tomatoes and things that require a little less skill. And it's a lovely way to let folks know what we're doing, how we're doing it, and it's great to meet and get to know my members a little bit better. In terms of the annual garlic harvest, that's a job that requires a lot of hands. And again, anyone's welcome. And we do have what's called a chisel plow. So that actually loosens the garlic from the soil, but it still needs to be picked up, put on a truck, sorted. We actually now, depending on the number of volunteers, we actually spray all the garlic first and then we set it out to dry in the barn.
Spray it with water.
It just makes the cleaning later 100 times faster. So because I'm nuts about garlic,
What
I
varieties?
was going to ask. So when we first started, we had a variety of garlic. It's a German hardneck recambole or recambole. I don't know how you say that in Italian. And it was called Elmer's Top Set. And we got it from a friend who was a good friend of the farmer that I was an apprentice with. And then we realized we needed a little bit more. And so we went to the Saugerties Garlic Festival and also got another hardneck German recambole. And so we combined those two varieties through saving over the years, and we actually just started calling it Indian Line Farm garlic.
Oh, no.
And that has been our primary garlic for over 20 years. And maybe 4 years ago, 5 years ago, I happened to be a little bit shy. And so I got some music and I got some German crystal. We have a Carpathian. We have an Italian red. Anyway, we grew a bunch of different varieties. We wanted to just see what adding to our supply would look like. And one of the things we found out was that grown side by side, the Indian Line Farm garlic was smaller. And it didn't look as hardy in the field to some other varieties that we were growing. And we saw that the seed stock had gotten smaller. So we've actually been incorporating some different varieties over the last couple of years. I still love the Indian Line Farm garlic because it's reliable. I love the taste. It's so easy to peel. It has the perfect number of cloves per bulb when you get a good one. So I'm not giving up on it. We're just going to be a little bit more selective on what we save.
Well, question on that is, will you have that at the winter market?
Yeah, right now all the varieties are kind of mixed up in the same bin, but I can kind of tell. I can kind of tell by looking at them. So
That's good to know.
I can try to find you an Indian Line Farm garlic.
I know you're always busy. I mean, really, really busy, but I'll just go in there. Which
Good. Great.
one? So we want to ask about your contact information again.
Yeah, we'll just do a mid-show contact info, and then I've got a question.
People can reach us through the website in indianlinefarm.com, and that's how you can sign up for CSA membership. It's very clear there how to sign up, the kind of shares that we offer. That's really the best way.
Wonderful. That's
My phone number is also on the website, but
Oh,
I'm not going
great.
to give it
You don't
right
have to
here.
give it out.
People can find it there. The question I have is about perennial crop. There were a couple of little perennial spots, and you made us do it for yourself, but I'm wondering about small fruits, large fruits, nuts, any other things you grow perennially, rhubarb or whatever you do.
We didn't really have any perennials before that. So in 2017, I put in a crop of raspberries. So we have several hundred plants. And then we put in a crop of rhubarb, which was exciting. We started it from seed. The raspberries did great. The rhubarb did awful. I think that it was just slightly too wet of a spot, or it really wanted a lot more fertility. We really tried to baby it, but it did awful. So I had to till it up a year ago, which was a big bummer because most people, when they have rhubarb plants, they can't seem to kill them, but it was not successful for us. But one of the things that I'm thinking about my older years and other things and trying to keep things fresh and exciting. So this last year we planted winterberry, which is not an edible plant, but winterberry is an ornamental and it's great for cutting. And if you drive in front of Windy Hill, all those red plants, those are winterberries. So we are excited about expanding our perennial crops. And in that respect, we're also working with a couple different organizations and individuals to expand our native plant population. So winterberry is a native plant. We're also planting a bunch of willows, different kind of willows, both native and more cutting and ornamental varieties to just have more stuff to grow.
Now, let me ask you about the winterberry. It is ornamental, so there's no edible component to it. There's nothing, or is there a medicinal, do
I
you
don't
think?
think the berries are, to be quite honest, I'm not sure, but I don't think the berries are poisonous to humans, but they're amazing for the birds.
Oh,
The
great.
birds love them.
Oh, great.
Mm-hmm.
That'll keep them off other things.
It's potentially, yeah.
Any
Well,
other perennials?
that's pretty much the end. One of the things I've wanted to do over the last couple of years is expand the native plant population around here.
Right.
So I was responsible for getting the Egremont pollinator garden up and running. And that's, if you ever want to go there, it's a really beautiful display. It's very large. And so I'm wanting to explore and plant some similar things that I had there in a very organized and beautiful fashion. And I'm working with a local landscaper to do that, to finish that plan. And then we're also looking again at this native plant population and trying to use the farm as a model so that then other people can potentially learn from how a small farm can incorporate both productive perennials, native plants, trees, pollinator-friendly trees.
I'm wondering about elderberry because if you have a wet enough site.
Yes, we
I'm
do.
just
We have a
wondering
lot of
about.
wetland, and there's definitely native elderberry growing. So it is one of the plants that I'm considering actually planting on the inside of the fence.
The elderberries.
Great.
Yeah, you can do a lot with elderberries. That's for sure.
Great antiviral, good
Yeah,
for cold.
No, I, yeah.
As the nation's first CSA, how have you changed the model, tweaked the model of people just get what they get? Because the original CSA model, I think, was a bag of stuff every week and the farm picks what you get. And if you don't want it, you get it anyway. You have a little bit of a different method, and I'm wondering how that works out, how everybody gets what they want.
Yeah, good question. So when we were apprentices, we saw multiple different examples of how people did CSA. And I was inspired by what they called the free choice. These farms essentially had everyone have the same size bag, and you could fill the bag with whatever you wanted. And I really couldn't make that leap. It just felt too hard for me. So one of the things we do is that we have multiple different tables with categories of vegetables. So our first table is what we call the choice table, and there'll be like 10 different things, and I'll say everyone can pick four or three. And that could be like a bunch of beets, a bunch of turnips, a bunch of carrots, or a pound of peppers. So in that way, of 10 items, you get to take three or four of those home. And that's great. And then it can be up to a pound of different kinds of cooking greens, chard, spinach, kale, mustards. So, in that way, if people don't like mustard greens, they don't have to take them. And then we'll do the same thing, a mix and match root table, take up to 6 pounds of all these different kinds of roots. And sometimes we'll put limits on it. People do tend to want the carrots and onions. So, sometimes I'll have to put a limit on that. I'll just say you can only have 2 pounds of this. You have to choose from the other things. And that's how it works. I do hear a lot of positive feedback that people like that. They appreciate not just having a box set in front of them and then they have to eat that.
Well, yeah, they have more engagement, and if you don't like a particular thing, you don't have to have it,
Right. Yeah.
which I think is
You know,
great.
and I think for the most part, people will experiment. In any case, they'll maybe say, okay, I've never taken a bunch of turnips, Japanese turnips. I'm going to try them this time. And then there's the tried and true folks who are like, nope, I've been here for 20 years and I'm never going to try a turnip.
Well,
And so it works for everybody.
you also have some wonderful recipes on your website.
And then we provide weekly recipes for all my CSA members. So I send out a weekly note about what's happening on the farm or just something that I'm thinking about. And we give out recipes. And then anyone who subscribes to my website once a week, every week that we are having a market, we send out an email highlighting a vegetable of that week. And so you'll get a notice that the market's happening, and then you'll get a bunch of recipes.
I'm wondering if what you grow has changed based on what people like. You probably have some adjustment there because otherwise you're going to end up with, say, a whole bunch of mustard greens that nobody wants, and the kale runs out halfway through. So you probably figure out, okay, we'll grow more kale and less mustard. Have you had to make a lot of those adjustments over the years?
Yeah, absolutely. The adjustments happen certainly based on the numbers of people that I'm growing for. So there's the expansion category. But I would love it if people just ate a ton more mustard greens. They're super easy to grow, they're easy to cut.
I'm
But
there. I'm there on
yeah,
mustard greens.
but the fact is that people don't. Not everybody wants them. So yeah, I have to be really careful because you can grow some amazing vegetables, but if no one wants them or you can't sell them, then it's a complete, absolute waste of your time.
And you
So
also have other outlets, like you have the farmers markets and you have stores and things.
I mean, there are some things, for example, that I can sell at the market more than my CSA members will take. It's kind of interesting. I also found that on Tuesdays, people are more likely to take kale than on Fridays. I have no idea why.
Well, going back to the mustard greens, because I'm a freak about those, all people have to try is a wonderful mustard green salad, with your radishes, and they'll go crazy. It's
Yeah,
so
I know.
good.
Yeah. Some people are really averse, though, to that slightly spicy flavor. So, just like some people can't stand cilantro.
Oh, I know. And I think that's more of a physiological thing.
Yeah.
It's like their tongue tastes it as soap, which I think is so sad because I love cilantro so much. And I can't imagine people not liking them.
Some people really don't like, I love
They
to grow
don't like.
escargot. And some people really cannot stand that slightly bitter flavor. So,
Well, I love dandelions, so
and then,
I'm the bitter queen.
and we've always had a customer who would like buy all the mustard greens that we've had.
Oh yeah, exactly. Yeah, we definitely did. I have a question. Do you incorporate foods from other neighboring farms? Is that how it goes? And what are those foods?
Yeah, so anything
CSA.
that I sell at the Great Barrington Farmers Market has to be mine.
Okay,
It's a
great.
very strict rule. The
Yeah.
Great Barrington Farmers Market, you have to, it's called a 100% producer market. So, like, someone couldn't buy in donuts and sell them there, just like I can't buy carrots from
Right.
someone else and sell them at that market. There has been a teeny bit of more flexibility at the winter market because there is no one else. So, for example, I've tried to grow parsnips multiple years. Sometimes I'm successful, sometimes I'm not, because no one else at the market has parsnips. They've allowed me to buy some from a certified organic grower to sell. That's very few items. But for the CSA, I do not grow winter squash, I don't grow potatoes, and I don't grow sweet corn. Those are very land-intensive crops, but I also want my members to have them. So I buy those primarily from MX Morningstar in Copaic, New York.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, great people. They used to be at the Great Barrington Market for multiple years, really high quality growers, and they're certified organic. They deliver to me, and I'm really happy to support them. They have larger equipment to harvest some of those crops a little bit more efficiently than I do.
And why bother with things that are going to not work for you?
Yeah, absolutely. I decided pretty early on the potatoes and then the winter squash. It had storage problems. We weren't storing it right. That also had to do with us being inexperienced. So I'm sure now I could do all that, but I'm actually really happy not to.
I understand. And just when you say corn, that alone. What are the pick your own crops? Do you have those?
Yeah, so members get to pick sugar snap peas, cherry tomatoes, all the herbs they could want, and green beans
Oh, that's wonderful.
and cut flowers. No,
Flowers,
do
yeah.
they come in a particular day?
I let people come whenever they want, but people are already coming on Tuesday or Friday to get their CSA share. So that's usually when they do it.
Oh, that's fantastic.
You have different people on the farm, not just you working the 5 acres. So you have apprentices, members of your CSA that do a little bit of volunteer work, and then other volunteers, and then you have employees. So how many of those do you have?
How can they get involved?
Yeah, so the Wednesday volunteer days are open and I'm happy to have people come. You got to be able to be outside. You got to be able to generally be on your hands and knees for at least a little bit of time. And you got to bring your water bottle because sometimes it's hot. We've fluctuated multiple times over the years depending on different factors. One, when I had very, very young children, I actually stopped having apprentices for a while because I didn't feel like I could give my full attention to them. So then we had just full-time employees. I trained. I didn't feel like I needed to give them anything else after 5 o'clock at night. So we've had, actually, since then, we have had a mix. I've had some amazing apprentices over the years. Many of them, probably over 60% of them, have gone on to do something agricultural. And then I've had some just amazing employees over the years, some for 1 year, some for two, some for up to 8 years. I feel very lucky that I've had just outstanding people work with me.
Oh, that's so
And you
good.
have typically at any given
Yeah, so
time,
you asked how many.
in
So
the season.
yeah, so on a given day, I need to have at least three people here every day. I've gotten flexible in the last couple years because people have other stuff going on. And so the last 2 years, I've had up to eight employees. It's rare that eight people would be here on any given day, but as long as I have three full-time people every day, then it works.
Oh, fantastic.
Great.
What are some examples of apprentices that have gone on to start their own farms and other great things?
Yeah, I often forget. I actually wrote some notes about them. So some of my very, very earliest apprentices, this young woman, she went on to start a farm on town land, and it was very educationally focused. So there was lots of kids there every day. She has since returned and is now the grower at Gould Farm.
Oh, great.
I have another very early apprentice, one of our first. She went on to start a farm with her brother called Langwater Farms outside Boston. And then she actually decided to then start her own thing. And so she has a cut flower operation. And then another woman who was never an apprentice, but she worked with me for 4 years. She is now the farmer educator at the Steiner School here in Great Barrington. Or
Wonderful.
they don't call it that anymore. They call it the Great Barrington Waldorf School. And then another woman actually who came to work with me from California, she'd actually had a lot of farming experience, but she has gone on to start a very successful farm in Cambridge, New York, and has a really beautiful farm stand. And yeah, so some real, it's just a handful of people. But I would say probably 60% of the people that have worked on this farm as employees or apprentices have gone on to do something agriculturally related.
That has
Great.
got to be really satisfying to know that you've been contributing to that. That's amazing.
It is great. And I do have to say that some of those folks came with a little bit of experience of their own. So it's actually extremely mutually beneficial. I love it when an employee or coworker has had any kind of other agricultural experience because they bring me an experience that I didn't get to have myself.
Oh, that's so wonderful. Well, this is definitely a question for me because I would like to know, how do you deal with extra produce? I'm such
Yeah,
a foodie.
so that goes back to Bill's question really about the planning,
Yes.
because that's what you don't really want to have. I don't
Right.
really want to have a lot of extra produce that I all of a sudden have to market in the middle of a busy growing season. So I'm pretty good about my record keeping and knowing how things are going to work out. That said, I do sell to Guido's Fresh Marketplace, and I send them an email twice a week. And they're extremely great professional buyers, and I love working with them. And so, if I do have extra of something, and sometimes we can work out a price that might make it move a little bit faster, they will often buy it. We've also, over the last couple of years, there's been an increase in buying from the local food pantries and some food access people. So, I've been able to sell slash also donate food to them. Berkshire Grown, it's called Share the Bounty. The Share the Bounty program buys two CSA shares for me a year. And then I, in turn, have asked any members who would like to give a little bit of extra towards that and or offering scholarship money for me to, at my discretion, give scholarships to people who request a little bit of break on the CSA cost. So I match those funds. And so whereas Share the Bounty's buying two shares, I give about 10 shares worth of produce every week to our local food pantry.
Oh, that's
It's
fantastic.
great. And I can be flexible about that also. If I am having a little bit of extra of something, then they might also get a little bit extra.
Oh, that's That's
Wonderful.
great. Farming is usually more than full-time work, and I'm wondering how you've managed your workload and stayed joyful about farming. And I know you said in the beginning that you have your downtime in the winter, or more downtime in the winter, but I'm sure it's not completely downtime. So how do you handle what people sometimes call burnout?
Yeah, good question. So I think for me, the most important thing is I actually wrote some notes about this too. So one of the things that's really important to me is to keep things fresh. So I am always like every couple of years, I'm like, okay, let's do something different. Let's let the mind think about something else a little bit more than the thing that we've been thinking about for 20 years. So, for example, in looking at growing at some of those perennial crops, that was just a really fun project to engage in over and above the work that we normally do. But when you get really good at growing the vegetables, then there's a little bit of extra time for other stuff. So the growing of these perennial crops and the winter berry and then thinking about cutting those for the future, that's been really fun. I started growing some tulips and that was really fun, just something different. So keeping things different and not the same every year, that's been a really important part. For me, it's been ending the workday at 5 and knowing that every day the list is always going to be there the next day. So I do my very best to end outside work at 5 o'clock. So that's been really critical. I also really don't work on Sundays and I have to go water greenhouses and things like that. The work is always on your mind, but I do not go out unless it is absolutely necessary. And the absolutely necessary time might be April when you're like navigating planting and weather and all that. So maybe in April, I'll have to work on some Sundays. But to really be clear about work hours, that's been really important. And then when I'm not working, it's super important to me that I try to have a life to do things really other than farming. I am very religious about working out with a couple friends on Saturdays and Sunday mornings during the off season and Sundays every, really pretty much every week of the year where we swim and we bike and do exercise together, which is just great. And I've also realized that I can't stress about things I can't control. So I don't stress about the weather anymore. There is literally nothing I can do about it.
Can you
So
say that a little louder? Because I live with someone who doesn't get that concept. I think it bears repeating.
it's hard not to do it. There's just so many other things to stress about rather than that. So in the wintertime, I also keep my mind active doing other things. Like I'm a Spanish interpreter for the organization Volunteers in Medicine.
Oh.
I go on lots of hikes with my dogs nearly every day. Again, I do CrossFit, which I love. It keeps me ready to keep farming. And then over the last couple of years, I've gotten trained to be a volunteer mediator. So I've been trying to get into that a little bit more.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. Now, this is just a side question, but you mentioned dogs. Do you still have border collie type dogs?
So right now I have an Australian Shepherd and I have, she looks more like a poodle, but so yes, I have two dogs.
Well, I love those herding dogs. They're kind of crazy and they're kind of wonderful. Speaking of taking down time, you took a sabbatical in 2016. It sounds like it was a wonderful, wonderful time to do that. And have you thought about, do you have plans of doing that again? Or are you just managing your time well that you don't need to do that?
I don't have any plan. I mean, I think if I have plans to go away for a year, that that would be the beginning of my retirement or my exit strategy at this point. I don't have a desire to do that. Yeah, in 2016, I did it. It was one of those things I really felt like if I did not do this, I was going to have to quit. I just needed some serious mental space away from the farm. My kids were the perfect age to take them to where I had worked in my 20s. So we spent nearly 7 months in Guatemala in a small village working. They went to school, learned Spanish. I taught English to a middle school. And then we also tacked on a 2.5 month cross-country trip.
Oh, it sounds idyllic.
It was amazing. It was ideally going to be our whole family, husband included. That's the one thing that sometimes I forget to mention that my husband is a super critical part of this farm. I'm the one who runs all the day-to-day operations. I hire and work with all the employees. Al also is a licensed surveyor and engineer, so he's only on the farm less than half time. But during that year, he actually stayed here and he came to visit us a couple times during the trips. That was like a segue into something that maybe isn't as important. But anyway, it was a really important year for both of us because we both got to do something that we had really wanted to do. Al wanted to build this little cottage next to our house, and he got to do that. And I got to travel and take a break from farming for a year.
And what a great thing to do, to be away also when there's construction happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was great too.
So what does he do on the farm? I think it mentions in your website.
Yeah, Al and I have very different skills, and he is the kind of person that can just focus on one thing and stay with it until it's finished. So I call him my project manager and my mechanic. He is incredibly handy. He maintains all of our equipment, fixes everything that we break. And then whenever there's an extra or special project, he's in charge of that. So we've built multiple things here on the farm, multiple greenhouses, multiple additions, remodels. We had our whole bottom of our barn remodeled, made a new wash pack in there. He's so well suited to those jobs that require so much detail orientation. And he has a way of not being distracted by the other day-to-day things that need to happen.
That's fantastic.
That's great. Now, on the greenhouses, do you use a climate battery? Do you use heat? How do you keep the produce in there going?
Yeah. In the winter, starting after June 1st, essentially there is no heat used. So there's no heat used from June 1st through March 15th. The greenhouses are only heated, and it's only one that even has heat in it, is from March 15th when we start seeds and early tomatoes till June. It's the sun that is growing everything in the houses, and the double layer of poly. And then in the wintertime, like right now, we have two layers of floating row cover over all the crops in the hoop houses.
So no heat, but you're keeping them
covered. Yeah.
Covered.
Well,
so covered. You might get down to like 15 degrees in there, or 20 degrees.
I grow crops that can take the cold. So
right.
All the stuff that can take a cold. I was a little disappointed. It got really cold really fast in December. And so I actually lost some lettuce in the hoop house, which is kind of a bummer.
There it is.
Yeah.
I know that cold snapped a lot of our stuff too. Is there anything that we didn't ask you that you'd like to share with us?
Not really. You kind of touched on the question. I am asked it frequently during this time of year. What do you do in the winter? People can't imagine that there's anything that I could possibly need to do. But as you all know, as growers, that the planning, the analysis, the seed ordering, the hiring employees and analyzing past seasons, any kind of new thing that you need to think about or do or decide, that happens this time of year, maintaining equipment, buying new equipment. I also get asked to do a lot of things like this. And everybody who never had a meeting any other time of the year wants to have a meeting. So I feel like sometimes I sit in meetings. But as I said, I'm pretty protective of my off time. So I know that if I don't take a break during this time of year, then I'm not going to get it.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right. And it's a good thing to do. Yeah. Self-preservation.
It's true. That's exactly what it is.
Well, we are so delighted to have had this chance with you. And we're glad that you had the time available. And we are very appreciative and understand what it means to take that time.
Thank you so much.
And we love your food so much. And we just want to give your contact information one more time. Bill, was there something you had on your tongue that you wanted to ask?
There are lots of great links on your website, all to say that, and information on how you go about the CSA, some of the history of the farm, and history of CSAs. There's a link to some Rodale articles and so forth.
And the next winter market is?
The Hoosie one, it's the third Saturday.
Yeah, it should be January 18th. It should be the third Saturday of every month.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Well, we'll be happy to see you there. I know you're going to be too busy to say hi and chat, but I might.
Yeah, please do. Just say, hey, remember me. Sometimes it is so busy that first couple hours that I feel like I don't pick my head up.
Oh, I know. I know. I've seen it. And we were very blessed to get your food, believe me.
Yeah. Good. Well, so happy you appreciate it.
Yeah. Oh, we do.
All righty.
Thanks so much, Elizabeth.
Yeah, thank
Enjoy
you.
Enjoy the rest of your downtime.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We just spoke with Elizabeth Keene of Indian Line Farm in South Egremont, Massachusetts. We have a little time left, so here's an excerpt from a talk by Dr. James White, who we interviewed in September of 2022, talking about rhizophagy, the way that plants get nutrients from microbes in the soil. Fascinating material. At touchtheearthmusic.com, I will post recording of the entire show.
One big area that we work in is the area of how plants get nutrients from microbes. The bottom line is, they get a lot of nutrients from microbes that they take in and turn them into endophytes. And these are microbes that go internal phyte plant. These are microbes that go inside plants and plant tissues. And how they get nutrients from those microbes is what this work that we're doing is revealing, trying to sort out how they get those nutrients. There is this process. There are two processes. One of them is simply nitrogen fixation, right? And these microbes can fix nitrogen from the air and plants cannot. And so plants have developed ways to capture these microbes from the environment, from the soils, because they take them out of the soils, put them into their tissues, and then they coax or extract nutrients out of them. And so in terms of nutrients from the soils, iron and molybdenum and manganese and magnesium and nitrogen and phosphorus, potassium, you know, these basic nutrients that plants need, the plants will attract the microbes from the soil that carry those nutrients, and they'll internalize them into the root cells. And this happens really at the growing root tips. So they're producing exudates out of those tips, and those exudates that are made of sugars and sometimes amino acids, sometimes organic acids, those exudates are really attracting these bacteria or microbes, because yeasts also can be involved. Some fungi are involved in this process.
And the mix of exudates they use, does that select certain bacteria species? Are they that much intelligence with the plant, or are they putting all this different stuff out and getting everybody?
The honest truth is everything is not clear yet, but it does look like plants, it's known that they change the exudates that they secrete based on nutrients that they need. You know, so you would infer from that knowledge, those experiments that showed that, you would infer from that that plants are somehow electing the microbes that will carry the nutrients that they need, right? Somehow they're, we don't really know how. You know, there's lots of deep, you think of the genetics of all of this, and it's very complicated. I mean, we don't know. No, we don't know a lot, right? We don't know a lot. We don't know an awful lot. Yeah, they appear to select which microbes they bring in. They attract them by the exudates to the root tip, and then they internalize them into those root cells. Then once they're internalized, the plant will extract nutrients from them, and they extract the nutrients from them by secreting superoxide onto the microbes. Superoxide is this really potent form of reactive oxygen. It's potent, it's very powerful, but it's short-lived. It doesn't last very long. So it's almost like for ideal for close work inside the cell, because the superoxide will hit the microbes, extract nutrients out of them, and then you don't have a lot of superoxide that hangs around inside the cell to do damage to the plant cell itself. But plant cells are also tougher than bacterial cells. The plant cells have sterols in the membranes, and these bacteria don't. So bacteria are more vulnerable to this superoxide.
Now, is superoxide just straight oxygen, or is it a compound? In the formulas on your slides, it just says, I think it's O or O minus.
With a negative charge.
Right.
So it's a radical, a so-called reactive oxygen species, right? ROS. We always use the acronym ROS. Well, that means it's just oxygen that's potent, oxidizing form of oxygen. It's got an electron, a free radical, right? That'll zap things. And so that's what's happening here. That's how plants are using oxygen. And in fact, they get that oxygen from the air, right? Mm-hmm. To produce that superoxide, they hit the microbes that are inside their root cells then with that superoxide microbes. And you can see those in online presentations. Okay. Then what happens is the surviving microbes will actually trigger root hair formation. Okay, so not all the microbes are broken down. Some microbes, in fact, are replicated and increase when they go inside the cell. And these are the ones that seem to be most adapted to the plant. So they then go into these root hairs and or the root hair initials, and then they will trigger the root hairs to grow. If we don't have those bacteria there inside those root cells, we have no root hairs forming at all. You just see these naked roots.
You just heard an excerpt of a longer interview with Dr. James White about rhizophagy, which you can look online to find. Previously, we spoke with Elizabeth Keene of Indian Line Farm.
Transform our way. To learn what ancestors teach us, honor the spirit residing in that which feeds us, act for the future of seven generations.
Archives for the show's broadcast in the last 2 weeks can be found at berkshireradio.org. You can also go to touchtheearthmusic.com, touchtheearthmusic.com. You can find several past shows. This is WBCR-LP Great Barrington, Berkshire Community Radio, broadcasting at 97.7 FM and streaming at berkshireradio.org, where you can also make a donation to keep the station improving and serving you, our community. Thanks for listening.